All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. How are you? Are you okay? I am okay. Back in the studios, shooting the TV. It's exciting, but it's long hours, and I'm actually recording this late at night after I've shot. But fortunately, I don't have to meander too much or noodle around or think out loud too much because I've got a couple of guests. I got a nice short talk with the amazing Dana Gould. And then later, after that, I talked to Lizzie Goodman about her book. Did you read her book? The Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. I was in the book, and I feel like I completely missed music at that point in time. I talked to her about that. But Dana, he's got a new comedy album out called Mr. Funny Man. It's available on Kill Rock Stars Records. And the new season of his IFC show, Stand Against Evil, is premiering November 1st. And Dana and I go way back. I love him. I love him. He's one of the guys I knew when I was just starting out. He was sort of a child prodigy. Is that what you call it? A comedic child prodigy almost. He started when he was like 15 or 16 in Boston. But always pretty genius-y. So, I know what I want to tell you about. If you live in Los Angeles, you Los Angelinos, this Sunday, October 29th, I want to see you at our only LA book talk and signing. I'll be at the Ann and Jerry Moss Theater in Santa Monica with my producer and co-author of Waiting for the Punch, Brendan McDonald, doing a little Boston, got a little Boston spin on the talking. This is all part of Live Talks LA. It's a 7 p.m. event, and we'll make it worth your while on a Sunday night. You'll get some book talks, some behind-the-scenes stuff about WTF, some secrets that you didn't already know. We'll take your questions. We'll sign your stuff. It'll be great. Bring your copy of Waiting for the Punch if you already have one, or you can get one with your ticket. Go to livetalksla.org to get tickets, or go to the tour page of WTFpod.com. That's Sunday, October 29th, livetalksla.org. or WTFpod.com. Oh my God. Long day today for me. As I told you, I'm recording this in the evening and I'm back in it. I'm shooting the glow. I'm shooting with the ladies, the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. We're doing it again, me and Allison Betty and the crew. But you know, you got to get up, go to work, hang out, wear costumes. Stand one place, stand another place, do the talking, wait, go up, another camera, change a lens, do the talking again. It's a little tedious, but when you do get to do the acting and you engage and you have that emotional connection, it's nice, it's good, it's exciting. It makes the world go away for a few minutes, which gets harder and harder to do. I hope you guys are hanging in. And as I said, I'm a little tired, and I've got two guests, so I'm going to lean on that a little today. So Dana Gould, what can I tell you about Dana Gould? He's been on the show before. He's had his problems. He's had his ups and downs. He's a warrior of the mind, a battler of the depression, a survivor of an alcoholic family, a father, a writer, Simpsons writer, and an inspired stand-up. He's the whole package. If you don't know him, you should check out his stuff. And as I said, he's got an album out now, Mr. Funny Man. That's on Kill Rock Stars Records. And his IFC show, Stand Against Evil, premieres November 1st, the new season. And this is, he just stopped by to chat. And it was a treat. And I want you to listen to me and Dana talking. Because me talking right now, not great. Not great in the head, not great in the heart, and a little tired. But this is me and Dana on a different day having a conversation. I don't know, man. How old are you?
I'm 53. I just turned 53.
I'm 54 today.
Happy birthday. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I'd have brought something. Now I feel like shit. Now I feel bad.
It's just nice to
see
you.
Thanks, Mark.
It's nice
to see
you. I didn't do that to you. You did that to you.
Well.
Don't you blame
You've
me.
Cracked it.
I'm not going to play that game.
You cracked
you
it.
You can play that game with ladies.
I know. I play, that game. I play that game pretty fucking well.
I know you do. Not on my watch.
I'm the Jesse Owens of that game.
Well, I'm
going, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
You have plans?
We're going to go out to dinner, me and the girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
Now, let me ask you a question about that. I know this is your podcast, but I want to ask you a question. She's not a girl.
No, I know. I have this. Yeah. I don't like partner.
Yeah, nor is mine.
Yeah.
But woman friend sounds like she's my nurse. You know, this grandpa's coming over, but he's going to have to come with his woman friend.
You know, you're getting close, grandpa.
Yeah, I know. And,
a few more years.
I don't know what to call that.
Some people go with partner, but I don't know. I just go with girlfriend. Fuck.
Yeah, girl. That's what I said. Yeah.
What does yours do?
She's an editor. An editor.
This a new thing?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How's it going?
Very good. Yeah. Very happy. Yeah.
How long?
Not long. Like a little over like 2 months or something. But it's been really.
Oh, good. So you.
She's an adult, you know.
Like, okay.
Yeah. She's a grown woman, has the children, you know, like we have.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So like even playing field, level playing field.
Yeah, yeah, it's very much so.
Mature relationship. I imagine that at this point, you've met somebody that doesn't give a fuck about the things that you both used to give a fuck about, and
totally, yeah. Well, it's when you, especially with kids, it's just you really got to prioritize.
Sure,
you don't like. I don't. The first thing that goes out the window is going to see bad movies. Ironically,
No, I
can't do that.
No time.
Yeah. But I am like at that point, like, all right, I don't want to fuck this up.
Yeah. Oh, good.
So.
Yeah, I feel that too.
Now, great. Now I have to grow.
Yeah, yeah. Or turn some shit off.
Yeah, I have to turn some shit off and be an adult.
Yeah, it's the worst, right?
I'm going to grow, he muttered.
Yeah, muttered. As he stuffed all his feelings.
Exactly. Like I'm just like a Halloween dummy of feelings instead of leaves.
Just walking around going, well, what am I supposed to do with this tone?
Yeah. I have to save this for horror movies. Yeah.
Where does this go?
Why are you going in the basement when your friend was just killed in the kitchen? And why am I doing Albert Brooks now?
Why not? It's relieving.
Why am not? Now I'm angry and I'm Albert Brooks.
Because we wish we could make it as endearing as Albert Brooks. When I'm operating at that tone, it's never endearing.
Yeah, there's nothing I'm angry. Yeah, just and I've honestly, like, you get to a point in your life where you can't keep blaming your parents for your shit.
Not actively.
Not exactly. Like, you can't say it, but we both know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you know, my family of origin, God love them, and I have great relationships with all of them, but I have still such little self-esteem. Like, it took me the longest time. Like, oh, you actually like me. Like, when I come over, you're happy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your funeral. All right, then.
Good luck with that.
Good luck. See how that works.
Let me show you some pictures of the last ones that tried. This one's from college.
Yeah. Look at the eyes in that one. Look at that. Just bats and screaming children. That's all you can see.
She thought it was going to be okay.
Yeah. Are these pictures of people just out of Dachau? Oh, they wish. Well, here's the. Do you know Dan Klaus, the brilliant cartoonist?
I've talked to him.
You know what he did for a while, especially in 8-Ball?
Uh-huh.
The characters would have these crazily existential, stricken face. What he would do is he would go into towns and he would buy old mugshots.
Huh.
So he was basing these drawings off people at the worst moment of their life.
Oh, really?
Getting fingerprinted.
I don't think he told me that.
Yeah.
I interviewed him. I know that he makes note of people. Like, he sees people, a certain hat or a certain, like, he'll see people in passing and sketch.
And he's such a brilliant observer of people in the way, like, when he was in Chicago, you look at the 8-Balls that he did when he was in Chicago, and everybody in there looks like people from Chicago. You know, everybody looks like a ham sandwich.
Yeah.
And then when he moved to Berkeley and Oakland, it took on more of that cast.
That's
interesting. Really great.
Where did you record this new special?
It's just an album. It's just the
record?
Audio. Yeah, it's a comedy record.
But available digitally as well, on vinyl?
No, it's only digital.
I want no one to buy it, so I made 1,000 copies, a small pressing of a record.
Yeah, I have. It's on Edison Cylinder, and no, it's just digital. And I said to the record company, "Let's do a vinyl thing." And they went, "Yeah, it's okay." They make money. They're a real record. No, we're in this to make a profit. We're not going to do that.
I think mine came out, it was weird because I shot a special for Netflix.
Yeah, Bobcat directed it.
No, not that one. This is the new one. Lynn Shelton directed it.
Okay.
Bobcat directed my Epics special.
Okay.
Yeah. But they wanted to do a record, and I'm like, all right. And then they're like, I was going to do the set. Do the same set but elongated.
Sure, yeah. You know,
and then, by the time it came to the wire, I'm like,
just take the thing.
Yeah, I did it already.
And I think that's how to do it. And I wish this was a special, but nobody. There was a brief period of time when Netflix gave comedy specials to everyone between the ages of 25 and 45.
Maybe I just got in under the wire on that.
A lot of people have comedy specials on Netflix that aren't even comedians. There's a guy at my Trader Joe's that has one.
I know that guy.
Yeah, the guy that sprays the broccoli. He has a special called Still Spraying. And I got there. It's like I always miss the door. Like I got like well, I get
you know
I get, no. And hey, you're gonna have your own TV show. I'm gonna be rich. No, not anymore. No. You'll still have to go out to Acme in Minneapolis and do a weekend. Oh, but I'm an exec producer of a TV show. Sure, yeah, I know. It's
sure, yeah.
And then.
Yeah. Yeah, that says that right at the end.
I can have
a
comedy special. No, actually, no. But you should plug the MC's comedy special because he did get one earlier.
You'll have a comedy.
I have many of them.
I know. You'll have another one.
But what I found
is... How do you feel about this moment where I did the comedy special with Netflix and was good? I was glad that I got the opportunity.
Sure, yeah.
But then you hear about Seinfeld, Chris Rock, and Louis. This they just gave Jerry Seinfeld $500 million.
Thank God,
because
I was worried.
Not that it's not. I'm not even jealous, but it's sort of like, can you give me maybe 5% of
yeah,
one?
Yeah.
I'm not complaining, but if you're throwing money away,
yeah, exactly. I'll take a little. No, I was, it was one of those things where I was going to tape it and then I was going to do it with a company that I did my last special with. And then the dates were confused. And then they were like, well, we can only do it on this date. And I was getting ready to go into production on season two of the show. And you can feel the material ripening and reaching putrescence.
Sure. And then you feel it dying.
Yeah, exactly. And I was looking at a necrotic set list, as they call it. And I really wanted to get it down. And I have a really great agent at William Morris named Silvio Lund, who's really a terrific guy. And he goes, let's just do an album.
Yeah.
And he called up this record company and bam, nailed it and got it in. And I do find that the audio lives longer than the video.
Yeah, I think so.
People listen to comedy on the radio. They listen to comedy on their phone. It's rare that they will sit down and watch a special again.
That's true.
But I will watch.
Because it's passive.
Yeah, exactly. But I'll listen to a special again.
I'll listen to comedy records I've heard before.
I listen to, because now, you have that done and then you're getting ready to go back out on the road and you've got to frantically
get new shit.
Yeah. I mean, I don't believe it has to be 100% new, but it should be.
Do you really not believe that? Or are you just telling yourself?
I really do. But I'm much lower than the percentage that it should be. I think people want to hear one or two things.
I want to believe that. I don't know. Because I think you and I are similar in that whoever's judging that, whoever's saying this is a shit from the record, whoever's saying that, usually we make them up. And
there are a couple. You always get that, 20% of the stuff is new.
Why do we listen to that guy?
Yeah, because he's the guy that hates us as much as we do. That's why.
He's just a little disappointed.
The way we are with our a little disappointed.
You almost got it, but not quite, right?
But I would, I probably saw George Carlin, a dozen times in my life. And I would always love it when it was like, oh, well, he's going to do baseball and football. Great.
He did it.
And you go, this is great. Listen to this. I still enjoy it.
Sure. I listen to, I like hearing beats. Like, you know,
because this music, it's a form of music.
It definitely.
It's a form of music.
Like, when you know, like, you know who I can listen to over and over again if it comes up? Because I got the shuffle going. I'm like, if Schimmel comes up, I'm like, oh. Because, like, he was such a master of this very specific type of timing. You know, this kind of, like, morose Jewish.
Yep. You know who it's the, he's descended
Jackie
from
Vernon.
Jackie Vernon.
Yeah, yep.
That, good pull.
Well, he told me.
Oh, there. Well, yeah, and you know who else was heavily influenced by Jackie Vernon?
Let me guess, who?
Stephen Wright.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
I love Jackie Vernon.
Yeah, Jackie Vernon was amazing.
It's great. He was the guy I saw. My parents took me to see him when I was like 11.
Oh my God, where?
That's what changed me. Because I saw him on TV do the slideshow, and then he came to Albuquerque, and I saw it in the paper. In Albuquerque, it was a lounge in the Hilton Hotel.
That's fantastic.
And my parents took me.
That's fantastic.
To see him. And that was what, you know, I was like, that's when I knew. And
what if he opened with him? So I'm taking a shit.
They would have been fine. But we were close enough just to see, like, you know, he's old and he's like, you saw all of it.
All of show business.
And I was not afraid. I was like, this is still good.
You know,
it's good.
I had this conversation with somebody the other day. This is really, really interesting. I was talking about how much I love Rickles.
Yeah.
And I was talking to a younger comic. Well, they're all younger.
Yeah.
And I was quoting some of his stuff, and this guy's like, oh, yeah, that's not good. That's not.
What?
Because he's so unwoke.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because, and like, it has nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
It's all music.
Yeah.
I love the beauty and the rhythm of the music.
Sure.
And I remember seeing him.
Sometimes he said things that didn't even make sense. But because
I will give you a beautiful example. I was with your friend and mine, Rob Cohen, at the Desert Inn, and they had just had a giant renovation of the Desert Inn, and it was sweltering in the showroom. And he goes, they got a $40 million renovation. They got a great air conditioning system. Two fags on the roof with a piece of loose leaf paper going, fa.
What does that even mean?
It doesn't mean a goddamn thing. He could have said tortoises. He just needed one syllable. That's all. He could have said bears. You know, I'm not laughing because I'm straight and therefore I'm exerting my heterosexual privilege in a derogatory way. No, he says, ba-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah,
that's what I'm laughing at.
But the weird thing is that, like, if you listen to someone like Schimmel, who is usually the victim of his own jokes.
Yes, and in life, had the life of fucking Job.
Yeah, and like with that, then the political, whatever is politically incorrect about it, it's self-directed.
Self-directed, right.
And then I don't like...
He's the victim of every joke. Every joke has a victim.
Yeah.
And in Schimmel's act, it was him.
Yeah, and somehow that can elevate. I agree. Yeah, I don't know if I've had these discussions, but like for some reason, I'm just able to separate. I don't know that, you know, revisionism is necessary just because times change in terms of what you feel personally attached to or what you like. You know, obviously,
I don't
Cosby's
know.
A little difficult, but I can still
As
make,
is Woody Allen for me.
Yeah, but I can still, you know, I don't...
But do we delete all that stuff?
Do we delete our emotional connection to it?
Right. I don't see how that's possible.
And, exactly.
And it's like...
Do
my
we
love
condemn...
Of, my love of Hitler's paintings. Oh, I have to separate.
You have that book too? It's just terrific.
I have
really
to separate.
Unsung. I have the coffee table book inside.
Yeah.
It's just called Hitler's Paintings.
A lot of angles, a lot of hard angles. Not a lot of people, but a lot of beautiful buildings.
Oh, yeah, but that's... I used to do a joke about that. It's like, well, you know, Hitler was a vegetarian. You know, like... You know,
but there's, and I think I also, and a lot of it is just being nostalgia for being a kid, like watching Rickles on the Dean Martin roast, and everybody, it's a totally different school of show business than you and I grew up with. Goldthwait told me a story that when he worked with Rickles, Rickles would just roast him all day.
Uh-huh.
And then afterwards would pull him aside. Now, are you set? Are you smart with your money? He was a very caring,
well, that's
loving
what my
kid.
That's what my grandmother said. Like, she'd go see him in Vegas and he'd shit on everybody. But she put it like this. He apologizes very nicely.
But the only thing with Bob that he couldn't understand is that he wore jeans on stage.
Right.
He's like, Bob, you can't. You have to dress nicely.
You have
to dress. And that's the thing that broke for that generation. Like, these kids... They wear
t-shirt
and jeans.
But that was Carlin, the kid he's talking about.
Right, but what I'm saying is in that era,
and
for us, it's I think it's like we understand that he can say fag or he can say whatever, and it doesn't have any.
Well, he's ultimately got to shoulder that. And if it's going to, you know, like, are you going to attack me for, you know, still respecting somebody who has not updated his arsenal? Yeah. Like,
that's a valid point that you do have to update. And he didn't, honestly, he didn't need it. I was watching him. I went down a Jerry Lewis rabbit hole when he died.
Oh, yeah.
And I was watching the Jerry Lewis roast from 1968. Rickles was on it.
Uh-huh.
The two things that
But that's a Friars roast. That's not even the...
Right.
Yeah.
The first joke that killed me was just like, Jerry, I say this from the bottom of my heart. Jerry, you're a Jew. Yeah. It's just like...
All right, yeah.
But the other one was, didn't he go, you know, Jerry's a clown and there are a lot of great clowns. Emmett Kelly, that's about it.
I love when he came up... He was on, I don't remember who he was roasting. It was one of the Dean Martin ones, and James Stewart was on the dais, right?
Uh-huh.
And he goes, Jimmy, I spoke to the family. You're doing fine.
There was one where he was on, it was his last Carson appearance.
Yeah.
It was his last Carson appearance because Johnny was retiring. Uh-huh. And then he made Johnny laugh so hard, Johnny got into a coughing fit.
Yeah.
And Rick was like, careful, John. Every time you cough, Leno's at home high-fiving the wife.
Oh, good one. I love when he got mean, like when it was like, that's some real shit.
Yeah.
Have you seen that one where they built him a club filled with... just celebrities, the Dean Martin. There's a Dean Martin roast. It might have been the Dean Martin show where they wanted to recreate a live Rickles show. I have it because I signed up for the goddamn...
Yeah, the Dean Martin roast thing.
They never stopped coming. I had no idea there were so many. But there was one that came. It might have been the Dean Martin show. But they set up a club. They made it on a soundstage. And it had people like Pat Boone in the audience. All the celebrities. Yeah. Ricardo Montalban. Like, it was probably 1970, early 70s, mid 70s.
Yeah.
And Rickles just went up and did his club act and insulted everybody.
Yeah, it'd be great.
It was great. He's just sweating.
In mid-70s, when the American flag had wide lapels. It wore an ugly jacket.
I know. It's an interesting question, though, about... Because I had this moment where, you know, being a comic as long as we have, you know, and you and I are old guys already.
And by the way, just to I am fully aware, before anybody jumps down my throat...
Yeah.
About Don Rickles and whatever.
Yeah.
I know. I'm done. This is not what is contemporary. This is my view of it. Pete Townsend was talking about that John Entwistle used to bitch about rap.
Yeah.
That he didn't get it.
Yeah.
And he said, it's not our job to get it. It's our job to get out of the way.
Right.
And I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I, you know, I can, it becomes difficult depending on what the transgression is to stay supportive. You don't have to be supportive of somebody. Yeah. You can condemn somebody and you think somebody's awful, but still say like that second record though.
Sure.
Yeah, you know,
somebody said a really smart thing. Do you know Marcela Arguello?
Uh-uh.
New comic, really, really funny. Really funny and really smart. And somebody was, you know, bashing some unwoke person who then apologized for it. And she said, you know, you have to let people make their mistakes and grow in public. You have to let people grow.
Yeah, too. You can't just terrorize them into some sort of cultural Siberia.
Yeah, yeah. My last special, the one before this one, I had a whole thing at the end about the R word, and how it's now equated with the C word and the N word.
I tried to do one of those bits,
the bit was about the strictly the nomenclature of equating that word with the N word and the C word.
Oh, it was actually addressing the
that whole thing. Oh, yeah,
it wasn't about like I don't use it that way.
No, because then I did use it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I said I would never do this, and then I did. I cheated all over the place, and I said it, and I said the N word and the C word too.
Right.
And I say them now with relish.
At home,
that's how I mutter myself to sleep. Yeah. But
so what happened?
I wouldn't. Nothing happened, but I wouldn't have done. I wouldn't do it today.
I did a bit about it, about defending, you know, the use of it. In a sense of like, in a nostalgic way, you know what I mean? I grew up with that.
Yeah.
You know, right. But then I got, someone, I think it was an email that just said, you know, I'm the parent. And that was it. You know,
yeah,
that was
really it.
And then I had a couple of slips. But yeah. Eventually I got a handle on it.
I did it, and then I met John McGinley, who's very on the forefront of all those issues.
Uh-huh.
It becomes real.
Yeah.
And it's not about First Amendment. It's about, these people have
feelings.
And their lives. And you go, oh yeah, okay. I get it.
Well, that's the thing, how attached are you to that?
Do you really need the freedom of using that word?
No one's censoring anybody.
Yeah.
It's like you're hurting people's feelings and it's already hard for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, that's brilliant. Yeah. It's like, yeah, they have a rough enough time. And that is true. Like, you can say that with Rickles talking about fags on the roof of the beach. Yeah. They have enough trouble.
My feelings about that are like, you say whatever you want, but you're going to have to bear it.
Yeah. Take the burn. Yeah. Take the burn.
And then handle it. What's this new, the new season Stand Against Evil? What's it? Did you finish it? It's all done.
Yeah, we finished it. It premieres November 1st on IFC.
How is it different?
It takes the story further. The premise of the story, is the whole idea of the show was quite simple.
Yeah.
I love horror movies. They're my football. So I just thought, what if I did a horror movie, but put a character in the middle of it that didn't belong there.
Yeah.
And it was basically, what if my dad was in a horror movie? Because he wouldn't give a shit.
And he doesn't know.
He does know. He doesn't give a fuck.
Right.
And we used to make that joke. If you remember the end of King Kong when he's on the building and the planes are flying around him, my brothers and I used to joke that if our dad was in one of those planes, that he would like fly out of formation, check the score in the baseball game, come back, shoot a little bit more, go back. And I just thought it would be interesting if, like, what if instead of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it was just an old Irish guy that didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And that was the premise. And I didn't, I, my mother is still alive, but his wife, who would have been my mother, dies before the show starts. And because I needed them to have a giant vulnerability or he's just an asshole.
Okay, yeah.
Then what John McGinley did with that was created this amazingly nuanced character.
He's a good actor, huh?
He's a real actor.
Been around for a long time.
Yeah, he's not fucking around.
He doesn't seem to age much either, does he?
No, he lives at the gym. I mean, his arms are...
Yeah.
And I say this knowing he's listening to it. His arms are terrifying.
Yeah.
He's in crazy. He's like an old Irish boxer from like a poster from the
1800s. But he was like in Platoon, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was in like five Oliver Stone movies. He was in Wall Street. He was in Platoon. He was in Any Given Sunday.
Yeah.
But he's built like an old Irish boxer. Yeah, yeah. You know, he's all upper body.
Uh-huh.
But he gave this character so much more than I had given it on the page. And I have to also give Janet Varney amazing kudos for the way she balances him, the ballast that she and is such a strong actress.
Yeah.
But because John had done so much of this work that for the second season, I had to write up to him. So I developed a whole arc of a storyline where there's a time travel element where he's going to try to go back and save his wife's life.
Oh, wow.
And as is always happens, makes things much worse.
Oh, good. Yeah. And that's the arc this season?
That's the arc this season, yeah.
And what's the name of the record? That CD? The digital?
I call it a record because I don't know what else to call it.
Album.
What's the name of my download? Because my download sounds vaguely filthy.
Yeah.
Mr. Funny Man.
And this is, what do you count?
It's on, huh?
Do you count how many you've done? How many records? How many specials?
I have the worst. I proudly have the worst album titles.
Yeah.
Funhouse is fine.
Yeah,
but it's an Iggy Pop album, and his album is much better.
Yeah.
Let Me Put My Thoughts in You. I Know It's Wrong, which is okay.
That's good.
And this is Mr. Funny Man.
Good. Well, I mean, the bigger problem is really the artwork generally.
Yes.
Is it like looking at you look at almost any comedy record, and you know somebody was like, "What was I thinking?"
Yeah.
Well, almost every comedy record.
Well, it's every comedian gets to be a rock star for that one day where you get to figure out your album cover.
Yeah. I did all right. Like, you know, in retrospect, I don't have any stupid ones. And the last.
Don't try to be funny on your cover.
Exactly.
Don't try to be funny on your cover.
That's it.
Your quad split headshot.
Oh, yeah. The worst
people from Boston, we both know.
Yeah. Oh, I think were there different panels, like in different hats? And
yeah, I can't say it on the air, but I'll tell you when we're done.
Pauly Shore had one of those. I remember seeing it at the Comedy Store.
I like how if they wear different hats, I know they can play different jobs. can be a fireman and a chef.
Is it Frankie Pace? Who is
it? I can't.
All right. All right, well, good. Well, it's good talking to you,
great
man.
Great to see you.
Dana Gould. The great Dana Gould. So, Lizzie Goodman, who I'm going to be talking to next in just a second, she was very good friends with Mark Spitz, the late Mark Spitz. They dated years ago, and Mark Spitz was a great writer in his own right, a music writer, and wrote a great memoir. And he was on this show, and because he passed not too long ago, you can still listen to that episode in the free feed if you'd like. It was a great episode. It was very personal, very engaged, and we miss old Marky. We miss him. So Lizzie Goodman, the writer, is my guest. And I met her, with Mark once, but she put me in her book and we talked about it when she was writing it. Then she sent me the galley and I didn't quite get to it. And then she sent me the real book. And honestly, I just skimmed it, looked at my part, but I have very little recollection. I talked to her about this, but whatever was happening in rock and roll from 2001 to 2011, I got to tell you, I think I missed most of it. I don't know what I was doing. I don't know where I was. I mean, the last time I knew I was really locked in to rock and roll happening in real time was probably in the late 80s. And then I went away. I don't know where I went, but I wasn't locked in. I'm locked back in, but the 2001 to 2011, I was just a struggling comic trying to figure it out. I got sober. Like, I guess it was right after I got sober. That might have something to do with it, but I just wasn't keyed in to the New York music scene. I was just keyed into the comedy scene. There was some crossover. We hammer it out. Lizzie and I hammer it out. And I like talking to her. The book is called Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011, which apparently are my lost years. But that's not true. I did radio, did Air America. I got divorced. Did I get married? I got married and divorced in those years. That would have something to do with it. So I was listening to music, but it was like 12 to 15 songs that I put on a fucking mix after my wife left me. A lot of those 12 to 15 songs. If you need a heartbreak mix, I got one. How long have you been in LA?
I have a real problem here.
Really?
Yeah, I've been here for 3 days.
What, are you frazzled? Do you know how to drive? Did you drive? Did you Uber?
I know how to drive.
Did you drive here?
I'm from New Mexico. I know how to
drive.
That's
right. We grew up, you're friends with, I always forget that. I want to go, I'm going.
You should, I think that's a great idea. It's great there.
How long did you stay in New Mexico?
Till like 14 seconds after I graduated from high school.
Which high school?
Albuquerque Academy.
You didn't tell me all this.
No, probably not. I don't know.
You went to the academy?
Yeah, yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 37. I'm 25. I don't know. I just had a birthday and I realized that I've been telling people my old age for at least the last couple of weeks because I forgot.
Yeah,
I'm 37.
Really?
I was born in 1980.
What was your old age?
36, as it turns out.
I thought you meant you had a go-to.
No. I have this joke with my friend Rob Sheffield that my age is 26 forever. I have not really evolved past that. I'm moving. I think I might move. I have to maybe come here a lot more.
Whoa,
now.
What's happening?
And so I'm thinking.
Oh, don't just drop that. Like I will. It means
well,
nothing.
One of my biggest. I've been thinking about where I want to live for a long time. Yeah, I mean, it seems to be happening. But
really?
Yeah.
In what way?
But I will tell you. But just my biggest concern is that I'm going to miss winter.
Uh-huh.
And one of my friends half my friends live out here. And one of my friends who's been lobbying me for an LA move for a long time was just suggested to me recently, and I never thought of this. Like, you go to New Mexico for winter. Go have winter in New Mexico. So
just go have a mild winter.
Well, it gets, I mean, it's cold. It's not New York cold. I live in upstate New York right now.
Oh my God.
So
where?
High Falls, New York.
What are you doing up there?
I was finishing a book.
This book.
Yeah.
That I'm
no, a different one.
The one I'm avoiding talking about.
The one you're avoiding talking about because you probably hate it, which is fine.
Hate is not the word.
Disagree with?
No, it's not even a disagreement thing. I missed it.
Of course.
I missed this. It's called That's The Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. I know none of the bands in here, really.
Would you like some help?
Well, that's what we're going to do, but okay, I'm not done. We're not done yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I like the idea of spending the casual winters in New Mexico where
Canyon
it's pretty.
Canyon fire, parkas.
White snow, luminarios.
Yeah. The luminaria vibe in Corrales is awesome. When you get your house
Everyone's
there,
doing the lights now, though. No one does the candles anymore. You can't go set them
on
fire.
No, they
do. Oh, good.
They 100% do. It's the real thing.
All right. Some people still do the real
thing. It's a very traditional place, Corrales, New Mexico.
Where do you think about living here?
I'm not admitting that I'm thinking about living here.
Silver Lake?
But no, I don't like cool people. I don't like them. I don't want to be near them. Like, I don't, wherever the Williamsburg of LA is, I don't want any part of
that. There's no Williamsburg of LA.
Thank God.
It's not, because here it's like block to block, you know, Williamsburg, like maybe, I don't know. It's different here.
I mean, I want to live by the beach, but everyone says that you can't live by the beach because you'll, you know, fall off the face of the earth.
Why is show business courting you?
Because of the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mark's like, oh, that didn't even occur to me. What a novel idea. I have to tell you something important, which is going to disturb you, but you know, some people like it. So it's
people love it, and I understand that. I'm not being
condescending. Yeah, for a TV show, you're not. I'm totally teasing you.
Funny. This book is about a period where you could actually get most of the people to play themselves as their younger selves, and it'd be pretty close.
Pretty close. Yeah, it is very recent. No, it's going to be, there's like documentary and narrative fictional adaptation series ideas.
Yeah.
Around.
That's great.
I'm excited about it. I mean, I want to do more of that stuff anyway and always have in the last few years. And so it's like fun to think about how to make, I've just felt really gratified by the kinds of ideas that have been, you know, because I was skeptical about the whole Hollywood thing, but so far the people that I think we're going to be working with are awesome.
Well, how did you start out? Where did you end up? You went to the academy, you graduate. You got brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I got a younger brother, Jake.
That's a good name.
Yeah, he's good. He lives in Nigeria.
Really?
He's a foreign service officer. He's a diplomat.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah,
State Department didn't cut him loose yet?
No. No, not yet.
That's good. Maybe in Nigeria, they're sort of like, let the guy stay in Nigeria.
He just got there. Mm. He just got there. And it's funny, we're talking about Luminaris. He's going to have Luminaris or something. He's getting married in December in England, London, and he's going to have all this New Mexican stuff. We've been talking a lot about bringing the New Mexico to the New Mexico Christmas vibe to London.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So, but where'd you go to college after you ran away?
Penn? I went to Philadelphia. I mean, I wanted to be on the
that's
East Coast
school.
Like right away. Basically. Yeah. I was all about New York. I was obsessed with New York and with the idea of like Eastern urban magic.
Yeah, you'd get that. When you grow up in a smart household in New Mexico, you're like, I want to go to where it really happens.
Yes.
I like all this cowboy.
Yeah, cute.
Cowboy intellectual shit.
That's exactly how I felt. I mean, it is disturbing to be talking to you about this because there's basically no one who gets out of New Mexico. So those of us who do all have the same kind of like core spirit about that. It's
people
like,
go back.
They go back. Oh, tons. Yeah, I mean, you're going back.
not yet. I've been thinking about it, though. It's drawing me back.
I think about it, too.
The way of life.
Yeah.
Like
me, too.
I'm done with New York. I'm almost done with L.A. Where else am I going
to
go?
This is how I feel. You say I'm too young to feel this way. This is literally the conversation I've been having while I'm here. I'm like, I will always feel like I live in New York, but I don't need to live there anymore. And so, therefore, where do I feel good?
Well, that's
only Corrales.
Exactly. Oh, Jesus.
Like,
me
literally
too.
Only Corrales.
I'm starting to feel that.
It's the only place.
For me, it's not quite Corrales, but I always romanticize Corrales, but I'm a couple miles away. I'm literally very close to Corrales. But, all right, so you go to Penn,
mm-hmm.
and study what?
English and classics.
And
like
the plan was only was to be a writer?
No. What a crazy idea. What idiot would do that? You can't be a writer.
What was the plan? To go to New York and what? Just like hang out?
No, the plan was to, I was 18. I didn't have a, I had a homing instinct, not a plan. It was like, I'm going to come to college because you have to go to college. Yeah. And like, I'll go as close to New York as I can go. And I was really a good student and I cared about being a good student and I loved school and I had a great time at Penn. But no, the plan, what happened was, and this is the right call. Like I now understand this in a way that I can articulate and didn't at the time, but I advocate for it. It's like I had to put myself near stuff that would, so I could be in a position to have what should happen next revealed to me.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like that's what New York is.
Yeah.
It's a notion,
for a lot of people.
You know, for me and for others that's kind of what the book's about is that sense of, I don't know why I'm going here. I'm just going here because it seems something's telling me to do that and I can't tell you why and I may not even know right away or for years, but it's where my next myself is going to emerge.
It's because the place that New York holds in the cultural unconscious.
Yes.
For years, you know, at least since the 70s, especially if you're groovy, artistic, you know, literary, it's like it looms large.
Yeah.
It means something.
It means something. It's an idea.
But still to this day, there's nothing else like it.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's why I can't live anywhere. I'm like, well.
But did you find always that, like I was just in New York and for the first time in my life, I went over to Jazz at Lincoln Center as a 53-year-old and it's always been there. And I was there for 15 years on and off and I did nothing.
You're like, oh yeah, hey.
Like all this stuff's available to me. Like people, like, did you go to the Museum of Modern Art? I did once, twice.
Yeah.
And now, like, I feel like I'm ready to do that stuff. And it's fortunate because now I understand New York pretty fucking well. I can get around. I know how to do it.
Yeah,
so if I go in for 3 days, I'm like, is there a show we're going to see? Yeah. All right, let's do it.
But that's okay. That is exactly why I feel like my current relationship with New York is among the best that I've had, which is like when you leave, you are able to be a kind of it's almost like the first 15 years are investing in understanding the place enough that you can become an informed tourist when you go there. So now I do that too. Like I go in from upstate, you know, every week or so, every 10 days, and I do 3 days of city stuff. I see all my friends. I go to restaurants. I do all these things that I had no energy to do because I was so relentlessly overstimulated by the time I left that I was like, I can't even, like, I just want to hide. And so now there's this, the slate has been cleared and it's like New York is fun again. But I don't ever feel, when I was 19 and started coming to the city from Philly all the time, I felt like I needed it to like kind of work on me in order to help me figure out how to become myself. And now I know how to be myself.
How did
I don't
it start?
Need
what
help.
Year did you go there? What year were
1998,
you in Philly?
I moved to Philadelphia and I was in school. My dad is a New Yorker. So my dad grew up in Stuyvesant Town.
Yeah.
And my grandparents still
I was on
live
a waiting
there.
List there for a while. Who's going to get that apartment? Come on.
You.
Tell me about the Stuyvesant. Tell me about your grandparents' apartment.
Okay.
In Stuyvesant
Well, it has
Town.
Pink walls.
Yeah, but who's getting that next?
Ruth Goodman lives there.
Yeah.
She's it's her place, man.
Yeah.
I mean, no one's, it's a rental. It's still like.
I know, rent controlled rental.
It's a deeply rent controlled rental. Yeah, your eyes are like glinting.
Well, there was a time.
Always a New Yorker. Always a New Yorker.
Yes,
ooh, rent controlled Stuyvesant. Oh, they've got like two bedrooms, real big. What's the kitchen like? How it? Yeah.
It's the last of the rent control.
Listen, everything you're thinking is true. It's your fantasy come true. It's like it's a
no,
big.
It's not.
No.
It's not like,
I mean,
you walk
great.
Over there, you're like, this would be good. Oh, but when I was there, like the idea of rent control was like, I had rent stabilized, but that doesn't mean something.
No,
after
I
a
had
while.
Rent stabilized too, but that's like, they're like, it's not as brutal.
So really, when you moved to New York in earnest, this is when this book starts.
Yeah. I mean, I started coming to the, exactly. Like I started coming to the city from Philly to see, well, the story is, it's in the introduction to the book. It's basically like I moved to New York the first summer that I was in college. So after freshman year, I moved to the city. I lived in my grandparents' apartment. I worked at
During
Sesame
the summer?
Street. Yeah. and I got a job in a restaurant.
You worked at Sesame Street?
Yeah, I had an internship at Sesame Productions or whatever. It was a production company that produced Sesame Street. That was my internship.
You were going for show business.
I was not going. I was like, this is the justification for me being here.
That's the one?
Yeah.
You picked Sesame Street?
I didn't pick it. It was like available. And really, I was like, I need to go hang out in New York City.
Did you see the trash can where Oscar lives?
No, they never let me near. It was like, I don't even remember what I did. I wasn't near actual Sesame Street. It was the production. It was a Midtown office building that was over.
You didn't go to the set?
No.
How could you work for Sesame Street and not go see where
Sesame
Oscar lived?
Sesame Street's production company produces a lot of shows. Sesame Street is the crown jewel. I was a lowly intern. I love that you're acting like this was my choice. Yeah, one day they rolled in and they were like, do you want to go to the Sesame Street set? And I was like, nah. No, that's not how it happened.
Would you not
no one
ask
invited
this?
Me. I was.
You didn't meet Ernie or Bert?
I didn't. I wanted to meet rock boys, Mark. I did not care.
Grover? No Grover?
All right, Grover I met.
He hung out with me at
the clubs. I took him to a stroke show. We were like, all right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He taught me how to ride the subway.
All right, so you're there. You're working at Sesame Street. Not like, going to the
not
set.
Not doing all the things that I know I've disappointed you deeply.
Yeah.
I got a job in a restaurant because I needed to make money because I wasn't in school and I had to like support, you know, I had free rent, but I had to like eat or whatever.
Yeah.
buy clothes, I guess, whatever I cared about at that time, records. And so I got this job at this, training to work at this restaurant across the street from Grand Central Station. So they were opening any day now and they were hiring up staff and I got this job and, of course, it took much longer for them to open than they had anticipated. So they basically had hired this staff of kids, bored, hot city kids, who went there every day for like 4 hours and got paid this lowly amount of money and did things like practiced waiting tables and learned the wine list and stuff like that. And my coworker was Nick Valenti, who was the guitarist in the Strokes. And he was in this band, like with his friends, called the Strokes. At that
point,
we were just pals.
The portal opened, and you're
well,
like,
"Well, no, I mean, no." It was years. That was the summer of '99, and it was. I mean, it was a couple years before. Like Albert, the other guitarist, had not joined the band yet. They weren't. It was my friend Nick's like band. Nick was like half-heartedly in college, and they were just city kids, and it was, I mean, the portal that opened that summer was not rock and roll, it was New York. It was like, oh, Nick was cool in that he grew up in the city and understood how to sort of like wander well, and how to get into bars and how to do stuff. Just it was what I had been learning with Training Wheels in Philadelphia about as a New Mexico kid, like how do you orient yourself in urban life and let these places kind of like, you know, wash over you and expose you to the things you're supposed to be exposed to, how to get the rhythm down.
Yeah.
And that like Nick and I would just hang out after pretending to wait tables and, you know, like wander around office parks and smoke weed and office park pillar, you know, behind office park pillars and sort of like just wander around Midtown. And then sometimes I would go downtown to like St. Mark's and sneak into bars and do stuff like that. But basically it was like, that was what was powerful
99.
About that summer. Yeah.
That summer was when my marriage was falling apart.
That was the other big thing that was happening for me.
For you, yeah. You knew Mark Maron's marriage was falling apart and he was
like,
out in
more
Astoria.
Weed. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he got thrown out of that house and he had to find a sublet. way down
you
on the
should
lower
have hung
east
out
side.
With us instead. It was way chiller than what you were dealing with.
I was just trying to do comedy, doing one man shows. Beth Theater.
Yeah. Oh my God, the West Beth.
Yeah.
Yeah. That became significant for me later.
Really?
Yeah. Because all the artists had their studios in there and still do. It's still. I mean,
oh,
the West
area
Village.
Connected to it.
Yes. Yeah. Right. The West Village became later after I finally moved to the city in 2002 became like my spot because I don't like coolness. Like I did not want to be on the Lower East Side or Alphabet City
but
or
like,
those places.
For me, when I moved there, I guess it was 89 the first time, and then I went back in 94.
Mm-hmm. I remember you saying that. Yeah.
But you know, and I talk a little bit in the book about the, you know, what happened then, but it really wasn't, didn't It only put. I was just a little weird historical artifact. You put that. This
that
guy
is
from
not
the,
true.
This guy from the generation before reflects on Giuliani for 2 minutes.
Well, I needed that.
I didn't mind. I thought I was well represented.
Good, you were. I agree.
Hmm. So all right. So this is all just before 9/11.
Yeah.
And you know, you found your place on the West Side where it's not hip with artists that are, you know.
Well, no. I mean, I went back to Philly for like. So what I'm saying is that that's why this is important about the book.
Yeah.
It's not bands. Like, I wanted to be a lawyer or something. I thought I was going to be a lawyer. I was a school kid, but I was pulled towards this sense of magic and mystery about New York City that is the idea that we were already just talking about. And I loved writing, but I didn't work for my school newspaper.
Yeah.
It wasn't like what it was, it was like I was being drawn to some expression of culture that was related to my generation that had not happened yet. And I did not know that that's what I was being drawn to, but during the next few years, in the part before 9/11, where all these bands, Interpol, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Strokes, and in, you know, White Stripes and other places, like around the world, all the stories that converge in the book, all of those people were feeling similar things, like a sense they were basically the same age as I was and feeling a kind of like, I want to make something, but I don't entirely know what it is. And like, the world is not really receptive for this kind of vibe. It's not supposed to be about urban cool right now. It's not supposed to be about notions of New York
City.
What
was it supposed to be about?
In the music industry, it was supposed to be about dance music in America.
Right.
In, you know, I mean, in England, it definitely was about dance music, or it was about like post Britpop stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and in my business, it was like, I mean, in the writing and what became my business, it was like, it wasn't that exciting to imagine yourself as a rock journalist because there wasn't a lot of cool rock bands. So
that's right. And it was sort of submerged in jam bandness too for a little while there, right?
So I didn't think, oh, I'm going to be a music journalist. I thought there's something about the way it feels to wander around Manhattan at 4 p.m. on a really hot day in the summer where everyone rich has left.
Yes,
and that's making me feel like I'm getting somewhere.
Yeah.
And I can't really tell you why. And so I went back to college and I studied and I kept in touch with Nick and a couple other people that I knew, and he would come and play shows, and then I would see in Philly and we would go see him, and I had friends in Philadelphia who were starting to like want to go to shows. So it was like, it was a thing to do that had nothing for years. It was a thing to do that had nothing to do with aspiration of any kind. And that was really important.
And it was also like, it was like traditional rock in a way.
Yes.
Coming back. It was not necessarily art rock. Punk rock was sort of finished.
Yes.
In a way.
Yeah.
And I guess like, I'm sort of, 'cause like some of the bands in the book I was given, like for some reason at that time when I was there in late 90s and then, like, I'd left by 2002.
Yeah.
But I was given CDs and stuff. For some reason, I have the Jonathan Fireeater CD.
Shut up.
I do.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
They were so amazing.
And I listened to it, and I was into it. But, like, what year would that have been? How did I get that?
Mid-90s.
Yes. Okay. So,
yes.
Okay. So, that times out, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They were the...
Yeah, they were around.
The Great Hope.
Right. I have my buddy John Daniel was involved with music, so I was sort of up to speed on some things.
Yeah, okay.
In the 90s.
Well, that's all right. I mean...
But like now...
Is it only good if you were there?
What?
You know, I mean that theoretically. Like,
well, the thing about looking at the book and reading through some of it is that like when I read Please Kill Me,
yes,
that was those were before me.
Yes.
And that was what everybody was going to New York to find was that.
That's what this is about.
No,
it's
I get that, but
model.
These guys were going to find that.
For sure.
And you kind of write about that.
Yes.
Like that's, we were all looking for that thing that was the remnants of it. And
yes.
the people that were involved with that, you know, first wave of whatever made New York cool were just kind of droopy, gray-haired dudes walking around in their leather pants that don't fit anymore with somebody going like, that guy used to be something.
Yeah, if they were even living there anymore. But I guess I just think that that's the continuum. I mean, it's not like everyone in Please Kill Me weren't pulling on. I see the continuum of that notion of New York identity as going much further back than just 70s punk. I mean, I think that whole idea, it's I mean, this is later, but it's
50s.
Yeah. I mean, it's jazz.
Yeah.
It's fucking Ellis Island, man. It's like it's in the American identity of
New York.
You're going to come here and you're going to reinvent yourself. And the cultural potency of that is almost as old as, you know, as the city in some way. And so,
but specifically in the world of the arts.
Yes.
You know, what came out of New York and then what sort of defined it is you had, you know, wealthy people who were willing to kick in to make shit happen.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Sure.
That's where you get a lot of the art from the 50s. Yeah, yes. Benefactors.
But then, I mean, you know, for us, because this is my taste and I think yours too, like the 70s punk scene in CBGBs is just like, I mean, Please Kill Me was my total Bible. I'm obsessed with everybody in that book. Yeah. I love that music. That's my stuff.
Right? I even came to that late.
It's another of your specialties. More material for the business card.
Late to the party.
Late to the party.
Catastrophic thinking.
Wrong kind of leadership skills.
The future doesn't look good for any of us. Mark Maron.
Mark Maron. Love Mark. But, you know, I mean, obviously, there's also the whole Greenwich Village. I mean, Dylan, for most people, Dylan is a touchstone for this. And it's so the idea that New York is this place that's constantly pulling on a previous, constantly kind of co-opting and borrowing its own past self to reinvent for a new group of young people, essentially a new for them version of the same thing, however that gets articulated, that's eternal.
Right. They could still find the space there.
If they can still find the space there, which is the question now. But like for this book, for Meet Me in the Bathroom, like I don't see it as, I see it as just the sort of the chapter in the canon of that New York cultural story. It's just goes right into the bookshelf right there, you know, after Please Kill Me and after Madonna and like before whatever comes next. But it's just, it's a stop. It's a stop on the larger train.
I think
that
what comes next is going to be a prominent either Chinese or Russian trend in rock music.
Do you have that on good authority?
It seems like it. That's me speculating in a non-catastrophic way.
Yes.
Your
vibe is not catastrophic at all, as you say that. So
when
soothing.
Now what starts to drive? When did you meet the late great Mark Spitz?
I met the late great Mark Spitz pretty early.
I assume he served as some sort of guide to whatever the fuck happened to you.
Wow, yeah. I think he'd really like you putting it that way. Well, what Mark would say is that he taught me everything I know.
Okay, there you go.
So he would want me to say it that way, actually.
So you're this bright-eyed kid from New Mexico through Philly who's looking for a rock fantasy, and that demon
and
comes out of somewhere.
Yes. He's like, I can help you out / ruin your life. And I was like, great. That's basically
fun.
Our story. Yeah, he talks in his memoir about how I was wearing flip-flops when he first met me, and he's like, they're not shoes.
Yeah.
Like, he was very, my New Mexico vibe was pretty, you know, I didn't wear any makeup. I didn't, like, I was still kind of, like, fresh scrubbed girl at that point. And I think Mark dated, like, you know, badass rock girls with, like, peroxide blonde hair.
Sure.
And he was sort of like, you are entirely too clean for me, basically. And I was like, okay, but you like me, so.
No, that's a recipe for disaster. Who's going to win?
Well.
It looks like you did.
Fast forward to later when he would say things to me like, you chased me, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, can you do this thing I'm asking you to do or what?
Was he writing for Spin when you met him?
Yeah, so the way I met Mark was Sarah Lewitin, who is also a great character in the book and one of my best friends, was my roommate in New York when I first moved there. So I graduated from college, and by that time it was clear that like the city's music scene was happening, and I felt I was like there to I was inspired by all of there was something to write about, and so I then was like, I want to be a writer who writes about this. But I taught second grade for 2 years first, because like, you know, you can't be a writer.
You taught? That's nice.
I taught at an all-boys private school on the Upper East Side.
Oh.
Blazers.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a double life for a while.
You were a real, like, full-on teacher,
Ms.
not a
Goodman.
Sub-teacher? Oh, yeah?
Miss Goodman, second grade.
What? Mm-hmm. And how did that end? Why did that end?
It's a two-year thing, and it's like you're assistant teacher, and then the carrying on of that would have been to go get a degree in education and, like, stay in school.
And what stopped you from doing that?
Oh, you know, Mark by that point, no. But yeah. He loved it. He would talk about how I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would go, because I talk in my sleep, and yeah. I would go, boys, get in line. And he would be like, Jesus, you know, like, fuck, who is this girl? Like, this is scary. She's like, yeah. So now
you're getting involved with the rock scene. Your roommate is, what is she?
So Sarah was Mark's like little protege at Spin. Okay. So I met Mark before I graduated from college, actually, at Coachella, one of the first Coachellas. I went out with Sarah to see if we could live together. We went to this rock festival together to like try it on.
Yeah.
And she introduced me to Mark, who was, I mean, it's in the book. Their meeting is pretty awesome. Like he didn't understand Instant Messenger, and mm-hmm. because I mean, he's Mark. And Sarah was like this sort of proto tech savvy little Jewish girl in New Jersey who liked his writing. It was like, hi, I'm Ultra Girl. And he's like, why is this window coming up on my computer? Eventually she wore him down and they became pals. And so she introduced me to him, and we had, you know, a sort of series of battles for about a year and a half, but then got together. And yeah, I mean, Mark was my tour guide.
Yeah.
He was writing for Spin. He was a hot shit writer, writing cover stories about all these bands. And
how'd you manage not to get all fucked up?
I don't know. I honestly think it's genetic. I really do. I don't know.
You didn't have the thing.
I went out and drank every night like everybody else. And like, you know, there was all kinds of drugs around, and but I just didn't care that much about it.
Like, good for you.
But it's not good for me. That makes it sound like something I get credit for. And it's not like I get credit. I mean,
not be compelled by that. To just to drink and smoke some weed and just enjoy the music. You don't have to go, you know, you don't.
I mean, I like,
you don't have to die twice,
but it makes it sound like it's a matter of sort of will, and it's not. That's why I'm saying it's genetic. It's like, I'm compulsive in other ways.
Right. No, I get it. That's why I'm saying you're lucky.
I'm lucky.
Yeah.
So that's how.
Okay.
I'm lucky.
So let's talk about, you know, the bands that define this thing and the arc of this book, because
yeah.
Like, I just, like, I think I got my first Walkman album, like, 6 months ago.
Okay. How are you liking it?
It's okay. I think I got that guy's solo record, and I thought that was good. I thought he was a good singer.
Yeah.
So the Strokes, you knew, like, you saw them become what they were.
Yes.
And then like, the White Stripes, I guess, were coming in from Detroit occasionally.
Yeah. But I didn't, the White Stripes were not, like, sort of first generation in New York of that world. Like,
well,
I didn't know
them. Who were the
bands
that were the?
Strokes, Interpol, Yeah, an LCD Sound System.
See, and, like, the whole LCD Sound System thing, like, you know, people are like, you got to interview Murphy, you got to interview him. I'm like, I don't know what he did. So, like, I had to play catch up with DFA.
Me too.
Jonathan, the guy over, what's his name?
Galkin.
Yeah. He sent me all this shit. Yeah. And I like that the Prince Horn Dance Call record.
Yes, good.
That first record. I love that record.
Okay. Well, you're starting well.
They had to go find me that record. Like, I said, do you have one of them around? They're like, it's not
one
a good
things.
Copy. Uh-huh. You know, we have one that's been laying around here that we're using as a mat for when you eat.
you're time capsuling your way into this. That's, you will love James, and you'll I mean,
listened to it. No, it's great. It's great. I watched the movie, and I actually narrated a short documentary on LCD Sound System.
You're like, who the fuck is this?
They gave me the script, and I laid it out. But like, I know he's something because he meant a lot to a lot of people. Like, I can see how they meant something to people, and I can also see how they kind of like, you know, kind of like, well, there's a gap here that was once occupied by the Talking Heads that we should climb into.
Totally. But the Talking Heads said that. I mean, that's what I got
no problem. That wasn't condescending.
Okay. I am not James, so you don't have to defend. No.
I understand how music works.
Tell me more.
I understand.
Do tell me more.
I understand that there's not a lot of new shit.
Yes.
And that you just keep reinventing the old shit.
I think, I mean, yeah, all right, sure. I think the thing that all the period that the book covered, what the book is about is not music. It's about all the things we already talked about. It's about New York. It's the central character. It's about what it feels like for this group of people at that period of time to do a thing that is eternal, as we just described, which is to be young and to feel unseen and to get together with certain friends serendipitously that you meet who unlock something in you, and to, in the shadow of like of theoretical anonymity makes something beautiful that makes you feel alive. I mean, it's pure. That's like, that's art, that's young people, that's New York City, that's rock and roll. But it's important for the book that the context is also for my generation or these people that we're talking about. It's happening in coincidence with all these other major global events like Napster, which is 2000, and 9/11, which is 100%, you know, a huge part of this story, obviously. And it's about, and then the reinvention of Brooklyn and the commodification of Brooklyn and the exporting of that via the internet, the newly born internet, to the world as this sort of notion of how to live, like a lifestyle brand birthed by, like when I interviewed James, he said, I was sort of trying to dip into that, like the Brooklyn idea and Williamsburg and all this stuff and kind of ease my way in. And he goes, oh yeah, that's all our fault. I was like, cool. Thanks. You know, and it's, that's what, so this story is about that, but it's about that through the lens of Paul Banks and Karen O, and yes, you know, later Jack White or the Kings of Leon guys or whatever, and then off to England and off to the Killers in Vegas and around the world. But
I had that record.
We should just make a little pile of what you did have. It'll be about three albums deep.
No, I've got more like, than I know.
Jonathan Fire Eater. That's an outlier. Pretty big. Yeah, that's a, you know, you get points for that. That's a big cred point for you.
Yeah, and I liked it. I thought it was pretty good.
But those bands, I mean, to answer your question such as it is, it's like there's no, like, yeah, there's nothing new under the sun. And this is a retelling of a generational story.
I believe that people make things new. I'm not one of those people that, I don't have a problem with appropriation. I don't have a problem with the evolution of music, and because like if you really look at rock, it's the people that really make something completely new are generally misunderstood, and you know, maybe years later people are like, I think I get it.
And somewhere they're like, no, you don't.
But there's a core group of fans that are sort of like, we're the only ones that get it.
Yeah, that bullshit. I mean, basically the story of the book Mark says this in the book. I mean, he's one of the greatest characters in it, where he's basically like, look, I was 28 and writing for Spin, or whatever he was, 30 something. Yeah. He was 30 already. And writing for Spin, and like Mark, who had an encyclopedic, thank you very much. Sandia Prep, thank you. Knowledge of music and film and all that stuff, was sitting there in New York City, loving New York City sort of, but just bored. And the thing that the sort of beginning of the book that everyone had in common,
was energized boredom.
Everyone was bored. James Murphy was bored. He did not know Karen O. Karen O was bored. She did not know Julian. Julian was bored. Julian didn't know Paul. Paul of Interpol. Paul was bored. And it was like, in their own independent corners of this town at that period of time, they all did something about that boredom. And Mark Spitz or Sarah or, you know, any of the other sort of non-musicians, but journalists, future bloggers, A&R people, like all the different sort of, I don't know, contestants in this, in this like roadshow, all had in common that sense of what we have here right now is really not enough. And we need to like, build something cooler, and no one else is doing it, so we're going to do it. So when Spitz heard, like, I mean, he says this hilariously in the book where he's just like, you know, when I heard the White Stripes, it took me a minute to figure out that I was being saved, because it was my job to write about Mark McGrath every day. And like, there, it was boring. It was bloated and boring. And that's the story.
I get it. It's like, well, boredom, like to classify all those artists as bored, I understand that. But I think that, in the history of what happened with punk rock and the sort of like, you know, kind of strange, angry, apathetic posturing that happened, is that what it comes down to, though, anybody who surfaces with any consistency may be bored, but they're workers.
Oh,
right.
Well, that's totally. I mean, and that's also New York City. Yep. Like everyone in that town has to labor.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you got to want it.
Yeah, and you got to keep pushing to sort of break away from the pack of garbage, because in any city, like especially that size, you know, for every one maybe original band, there's going to be like 20 guys just tooling through rehash.
Especially in an era where, I mean, it's hard to overstate this, and it seems crazy now, but I mean, it really seems crazy now, but like being in a rock band, I love the guys in Jonathan Fireeater talk about this, and later the Walkmen. They talk about how like telling your friends that you were in a band was like, ugh, now well, I have to go see
over?
You play. Yeah. It was like, really?
Didn't that, electronic music kill something?
Yeah, aren't we? Do we have to go through this charade of seeing you play?
Do we have to go to Brownies?
Yes. On Thursdays at 7. You know, like, you're going to make us do that. You'll buy us drinks, right? I mean, it was like the least possible cool thing to do. And it was like lame and kind of an imposition on your friends to ask them to come see you play.
Sure.
So this whole, it's hysterical because relatively quickly people would be dressing across the country and around the world like they had just been thrifting on the Lower East Side, but not when these bands formed.
But that's interesting because that whole thing, you know, that thrifting thing has reinvented itself with every generation of people.
Yeah.
It's like, and now like they're thrifting 1980s clothing and I'm like, no.
I know. It's, you know, I know. I'm feeling that too.
It's weird. Like, because when I was in high school, we were thrifting shark skin.
Yeah. That's better.
Yeah, yeah. And then that kind of the whole, you know, that rockabilly kind of blues, like whatever the fuck it was.
Yeah.
You were going after those suits and those skinny ties.
Can we speak to someone about this? Like, can we address this with the culture in general that we just nominate certain eras as out of the loop of going to be rediscovered?
Well, some of them, that shit's not even around anymore. Like, you know, fortunately for now, everything is made so badly.
I know. It'll never happen. People will never be thrifting 2017.
No, the H&M shit is not going to hold up.
Maybe we've inadvertently solved the problem
by
having...
The Urban Outfitters that was stealing the fashions that were previously thrifted is not even making shit that'll hold up to be thrifted.
So maybe we just need a generation to cycle through that. And in like 20 years, people will actually have to create new stuff because it literally will have all disintegrated.
You have to create outfits that will withstand the heat.
Yeah. Oh,
I'm sorry.
You're picking me right out there.
I did it. I did it again.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. We're going to be wearing enclosed outfits of some sort.
You know, New Mexico is supposed to fare relatively well. I mean, water is going to be a huge problem. But
water is going to be a problem.
But we have the mountains.
We have aquifers, though. Aren't we right on an aquifer?
Oh, yeah. We give a lot of, as I understand it. No, wait. I think we give a lot of water to California.
So,
motherfuckers.
Well, you know, California's thirsty, man. It's always thirsty.
Yeah. Okay.
So, like, I know Eleanor Freeberger. This is what I did with the list of names.
No, you read all your quotes first. Come on.
Of course.
Yes, okay. Then you looked at the list of names.
Yeah, and then I kind of poked around it, like, you know, the chapter headings.
Yes.
But like, I don't know Grizzly Bear. The National I came much really late to, and I understand why they're good, but I don't know that I go back to the records that much. TV on the Radio.
Amazing.
I listened to their first and second record. I'm like, holy shit, this is amazing.
Yeah, they're incredible.
Yeah. The AAS, first couple records, I listened to them. I had them. The Hives, I had that record.
Okay.
I remember liking it.
What's your problem?
Nothing. We're just getting Vampire Weekend. Don't think I've ever heard them.
All right. Well,
Interpol, I think I got a recent record with like they're back, and I'm like, I missed it the first time. Pretty good. Libertines, just got a Libertines record.
How are you feeling about it?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of punky, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, we'll come up on something and you'll be like, you really have to go and do that.
Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah.
Well,
I buy a lot of records. I'm in a renaissance of music appreciation.
I'll send you a list. I mean, I don't know. Like,
I have your book. I
know.
Yeah.
Well, you do though, actually, because you can't start. Go on. You know, you
Moldy Peaches.
Yeah, amazing. Did you play Who's Got the Crack?
I don't have it.
All right. Well, you should play that. Play Who's Got the Crack by the Moldy Peaches.
It's just one song.
Well, that song in particular is your gateway drug for them.
David Cross, comedian. I know him. Yeah. Familiar with his work.
Yes. Are you?
Yes.
Uh huh.
Hold Steady. I like that guy. Craig's a good
Craig's
guy.
Craig's pretty great, right?
Yeah. He's a good talker. He's a thinker. He's good. The Killers. I like that. Okay. Kings of Leon. First two records.
Incredible.
Then what happened?
Well, yeah. But okay. That's another alternate title for this book.
Sure is.
Yeah.
Where's the staying power?
Well, they're all still making albums and touring and doing well.
Yeah.
Like literally all of these people.
Yeah.
Okay,
let's talk about then what happened. What did happen? Well, let's first talk about like the hole that, you know, 9/11 left in the world. And that like in terms of...
And you're all over that chapter. See, that's another place that used you.
But compounding the like whatever that boredom was that horrendous existential like just terror, sadness, grieving... Like, I think I talked to Spitz about that a bit,
too. Yes, you did. Yeah.
But a lot of this came out of that.
Well, it didn't come out of it.
It
was positioned, as gross as that word is under the circumstances, to be heard in a different way and by more people as a result of it. So like, you know, none of these important records, the first Yeah Yeah Yeahs record, the first Strokes record, the first Interpol record, early DFA stuff,
yeah,
none of that had been, was written post 9/11. It was not a response to that.
No,
it was written before, but it was about, you know, it was about all these themes that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Culture considered obsolete, like sadness and anxiety and loud guitars as a solution to that, or as an expression of that, as a response to being alive, right? It was like, oh, that's old news. And then, you know, the towers come down and New York City is under attack and America is under attack. And it makes you kind of return to the sort of like core aesthetics of rebellion. And that's rock and roll. So what do you want to hear? You want to hear Jack fucking White playing guitar. You want to hear the urgency of the first Strokes record. You want to, you want a kind of a manic toughness. You want that.
I'm hip to that, yeah.
And I think, so these bands who, it's not like if 9/11 hadn't happened, the Strokes wouldn't have broken in England. They had already broken in England and kind of ignited this industry-wide like double take towards New York before 9/11 happened. Their album was supposed to come out like the week after 9/11, the first one in the States. So it was already kicking off. But what 9/11 did is a couple of things, I think, and this is argued in the book. It increased the number of people who were immediately feeling the need for that kind of sound. And it also turned the world's attention to New York City culturally in a way that it had not been, it had not had the attention of sort of like global cool hounds in that way in
got the 70s. Attention for perseverance.
Yes.
You know,
everyone, I mean,
strength, sympathy.
Yeah.
You know, Bruce Springsteen had to go to
work. Yeah. Bruce Springsteen got the bat call. Time to hit it, you know? And I think, I mean, all these bands talk about touring in the wake of that and being
doing comedy in the wake of it.
Sure. But being cast as kind of emissaries for New York, and again for this idea of what New York is about that the entire world on some level was either loving or hating at that point in new ways, because
it was interesting time, because if you were a New Yorker and you did live there, you were like, we're gonna fight.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
And we're thinking about that now. Yeah. And the other thing that it did, I think, for the purposes of this scene such as it is, and Tunde from TV on the Radio talks about this in the book, I think when he said this to me, it really kind of, it was a turning point from my understanding of this. He talked about how basically he thinks 9/11 put a kind of pause button on the gentrification race that was already happening. I mean, the sort of post the Giuliani into Bloomberg cleaning up of everything that would eventually result in the New York, the slick anodyne New York.
I don't even know who lives there.
No one does. It's Saudi billionaires who have apartments.
Right, they're summer homes.
Yeah, they're summer homes that they like might go to.
It seems
maybe.
French, Russian,
it's
Saudi,
all yeah, it's and it's just it's well
Chinese.
I don't know what it
no,
is.
No, no, it's just it feel like it. It feels like it doesn't have a cultural identity. It has an architectural identity.
Yes. And the identity right now is money. Money has a bleaching effect eventually on culture, I think. And right now, New York feels to me like burnt out, literally like whited out. Like, not, right. I don't, I'm not talking about race.
Not burnt out in the way that it was burnt out when it was bankrupt, but burnt
not
out
good
in the
burnt
way
out.
That,
like,
right, that, that.
Like acid has been poured on it and it's like bleached out, you know? Like, I don't know. I mean, I keep seeing, you know, I don't know what causes this, but when
the
a screen
creative
turns,
spirit has been deadened.
Yeah, by capitalism.
Yeah,
man.
By money. And by people that don't, that they don't, like, it'd be interesting to really explore what is rooting there, you know, in the sense that, you know, it is completely antithetical to what it used to be when it was. Well, I think the big difference was there was a time where always money there, but the people that worked there could live there.
Yes. And now that's not true. And what's funny, and not haha funny, but of course, like, the it's all connected to this era, because that's why James saying it's our fault is funny. In again,
Brooklyn,
like Brooklyn, because it's all those people New York became the kind of place where you would invest in that kind of apartment because of all of the culture that re-enlivened it and made it interesting and sort of buzzy and brandable in that way. And now all these people who bought there on some level, whether they know it or not, as a result of this latest incarnation of that New York thing, live in a place where none of those people can be. But this is also, like, in a way so boring because it's like, no shit.
Yeah.
That's called the cycle of art. That's called, like, art versus commerce 101. I mean, it's going to just play itself that way over and over.
They all moved out of the city. Like, that generation of artists, once they got money,
they all live here. They all live here.
Or they live in New Jersey or Connecticut or Brooklyn or, you know.
No, a lot of them keep sort of like, I love this. I understand this instinct. I feel this instinct. They keep places in New York.
Yeah.
Like a little apartment on near the Bowery or a little whatever. And just to kind of be like, no, no.
I still got
that's
a
me.
Bed there.
That's me. Yeah. I still have a place to rest.
But like, the arc of this book from, you know, 2011 sort of ends in Brooklyn becoming the... like the wealth center of hipsters.
Totally. And that, but also just that.
That did it ever have any integrity other than like.
Yes, for sure. But I also just think it's, yes, it did. I will answer that. But also that the idea that that would have, one of the things that's hard to see from now because it's so obvious that that is what took place is how unlikely that seemed. That that would, at the time, if you had been sitting there in 2002 and sort of prognosticating that in 10 years or whatever, like Williamsburg, a place you could not get cabs to take you, was going to be the default locus of cool for the globe.
It's weird because there was some,
you would have been laughed out of that conversation.
Well, it's sort of like I lived in Astoria. I had an apartment in Astoria from 95 till like 2000 and you know, whenever they my subletter was just informed by the new owner of the building that he now had the lease.
quick note, but like, a note when, under the door.
But there were people like Louis had a place in Williamsburg.
Yeah.
There were people moving into Long Island City.
Yeah.
And like, so it was sort of happening, but that was because you could get space for still relatively
happening. It's just like everyone moved to Williamsburg because it was cheap.
Right.
And because, to return to what Tunde is saying, I mean, it was like you could get free. He and Dave Siddick met each other because they lived in the same converted loft and they were passing each other's rooms enough and seeing that the same shit basically was on the floor of each other's rooms. And it was sort of like, I guess we should probably talk. You know, you've got the same weird stuff in there
lofts.
That I have in like lofts. And that's not like, it's so easy to be like, wow, that must have been so cool. And it's like, it's only romantic later. At the time, it's like, I need to live somewhere and be able to paint.
But that's
the story of the, I mean.
Right. But that context or that framework of life has repeated itself.
Yes, exactly.
Generation to generation.
Sure, totally.
The loft.
So the loft, that's another title that we keep. Yeah. But the thing about 9/11 that Tunde was saying that's important is that whole gentrification we're talking about and the money and the bleaching out or however you want to phrase it. Basically his theory, and I buy this now, is that that was coming much sooner and 9/11 paused it because there was a sense, I mean, people thought no one would travel there anymore. No one wanted to get on planes. It was like
people were leaving.
For a second, it was like, is New York's economy going to die? So there was this really like,
are things going to get cheap in East Village?
They were. Are things going to, you know, plummet here? Is it going to be the 70s New York thing again? Because tourism will die and no one will want to live here and all that stuff. Is there going to be? Because it was terrifying and it was like, you know. Every plane that flew overhead, there were a couple years where, and so what that created for the purposes of this book is this weird period of uncertainty that was really a gift to these bands because there was a couple years, and this was my heyday really of like going out and seeing shows during that time. It was 2002, 2003, maybe into 2004, but barely, where it was like, it was just wild. Everyone was like, are we going to die? Okay, let's party. And it got druggy and it got dirty and it wasn't that expensive yet. Rent wasn't going up really. Uh-huh. It was sort of just like the whole apparatus was trying to figure out how this was going to shake out. And it was like, cool, let's play.
Yeah. You know, you should read, you know, a book it sort of answers some of those questions behind the scenes.
What?
Did you ever read that book, Securing the City?
Mm-mm.
Oh my God.
Who wrote it?
I recommend this book to so many people. I should have.
Did you secretly write it?
No.
Oh, good cover. It's ominous.
Yeah, it's about
it looks like the beginning of every Law and Order old school Law and Order episode. Yeah.
It's by Christopher Dickey, who I believe is James Dickey's son. Okay. And I still see him as he shows up on shows on CNN and stuff. But it's really about how New York had to create its own counter.
Yes. Oh, I should read this.
This
would be
interesting.
Yeah, because it was like we're our own city and we have to protect ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah, because federal government and the CIA and the FBI were not talking really.
Yeah.
There was, and the federal government was not really stepping up.
And
so these guys
didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, and it was Giuliani still who was like, we've got to make our own counterterrorism force, and we've got to have international.
And Ray Kelly.
Yeah, Ray Kelly. Yeah,
dude.
And this guy Cohen. It's great.
Okay, I'll read this. Like, and then I'll be like, I should have talked to him for the book. Fuck. This is my life. Like, I wake up still at night being damn it.
Next edition.
Don't even joke about that.
Why?
I'm never writing another oral history ever again.
It's hard to organize.
Oh, it made me move upstate to a cabin in the woods by myself because I had an emotional breakdown. Like, it's so hard. The organization is really a nightmare.
Well, you did it and people like it.
Yeah.
And, it seems to be all in there.
Yeah, you did a little perusal. Check it out. Make sure.
What are you talking? What do you want from me?
I think it's hilarious. I'm excited. My favorite people around the book are like that. One of my favorite pieces written about the book was by my friend Dan Ozzie.
Yeah.
Who does not like any of this music. Basically, he's in the book talking about Conor Oberst because he loves Conor Oberst, but he basically doesn't. He's a music nerd and a rock critic, and he's just like, all of these bands suck, basically. I mean, not literally, but it's not his stuff.
But the thing is, like, I'm not a Conor Oberst fan, but I had him in here.
Yeah.
Some of my best interviews are with people who I'm like, I don't get it.
Well, that's why I'm saying, like, I'm saying I enjoy the fact that this isn't your world. I think that's more fun.
Well, I can learn
as
more.
As the creator of this project, yeah, to talk to someone like that than someone who's like, Julian Casablancas is my favorite rock star of all time. You're like, well, you're going to love this. Boy, do I have a book for you. Like, this is writing. I take this part of journalism seriously. Like, it's not my job to write a press release for one of these bands. It's my job to convince those who aren't naturally inclined to take this as interesting that there's something there.
Well, here's what I have to say. I'm happy you kids had your time.
Okay. Are you going to try to say that was not condescending? Because I'm not going to. That's not sellable.
That was a joke. That was a joke.
And was it?
It was a sarcastic condescension.
Ha 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 ha.
let's shift gears to more serious shit.
Okay.
Then the
private police state arranged by Giuliani.
Well, no, just personal stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure,
like, I haven't talked to you really since Mark passed away.
Yep.
I eulogized him on this show.
Yes, thank you for doing that.
And, because I like the guy, and I literally, texted him like a week before it happened.
Yeah.
Do you talk about what happened? Can you talk about it or no?
I can totally talk about it. I like talking about it. I think people are a little afraid, understandably, to ask me about him because it's fucking
because you guys
painful.
Were friends. You were romantically involved on and off.
Yeah.
You were best friends. He was, on the up and up again, it seemed.
Yes, 100%. It's really tragic. I mean, the answer to what happened, which is what I guess is like not known, I suppose. I mean, I don't really know. I don't know
anything other than he died. And then I texted you to say sorry. But then I got no information. And then, you just sit there and go like, well, what happened? It's not. He's one of those guys where you're like, it was bound to happen, but it didn't seem like it was going to happen that way.
Well, a lot of people, you feel like it's bound to happen and then it doesn't. I mean, Mark had a history, obviously, of drug use, and I think most people assume that he died of an overdose, and that's not what happened. We don't know for sure because there was not an autopsy performed.
Huh.
So there's no, like...
Was there a cause of death? Heart attack?
I mean, cause of death unknown as far as I know.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is what you're not afraid to talk about? We have no information?
Kind of, except, I mean, I guess I was here. And, we shared custody of our dogs. So Mark and I were together for 6 or 7 years in my 20s. And then we broke up like 10 years ago. But we stayed incredibly close friends. And he was my creative partner, basically. Like that Mark, this book would not exist without Mark. He was the person on the other end of the line consistently throughout my entire career. Well, like not, I mean, sometimes, but like sometimes it was nitty gritty stuff, but more just... All writers need like the all people, I guess, but the sort of like, who's on the red phone? Uh-huh. You know, it was like, I don't know, and this isn't working, and what do I do? And like, help. And also, I just need to vent. It's like, that was Mark. We were really, really tight creatively. And he would do the same. We would talk to each other about writing every day and our dogs. And so I was out here, and he had been in a period of incredibly bad depression for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably his whole life, but it had been really bad. And I was helping him, and his family was helping him, you know, try to get the right mental health care, which never quite came together for him. And eventually, after a couple of years, like in the month before he died, he was better than I'd ever seen him. He may have told you that. I mean, he was like
running a little bit.
Yeah, he was taking better care of himself.
No,
and he hadn't been. I mean, I think I know that Mark lied to me about drugs over the years, but he wasn't like. Here's what happened the night that he died. He went to a bar. The night that I think he died, he went to a bar because he. I mean, we don't know exactly when he died. He went to a bar on February 2nd and he had a couple of drinks, like a drink and a half with a friend and at 6:30, something like that. And he came home and he walked the dogs with this friend and he was inside his house with the chain on the door and the locks on the door and a bowl of pasta on his like coffee table.
That's how they found him.
And I didn't hear from him the next day and I was worried and I didn't hear from him the next morning and he didn't do that with the dog. I mean, he was the dog thing. Mark loved those dogs more than anything in the world and wouldn't fuck around with their health and knew I was all the way out in California. I mean, he was like more neurotic about the dogs than I am.
Yeah.
And that's how eventually I woke a bunch of people up and his super went into his apartment and he found him just slumped over on his couch with dinner on the table. So like, as I have never done heroin, but my understanding is you don't make a big bowl.
That's right.
And also there was no drug paraphernalia in his house and no drugs found.
Organ went.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it's an aneurysm or a heart attack or what. And the dogs were fine. They were in that house with him for 36 hours and they were thirsty and
they didn't eat the pasta.
He would love that. He would have fucking loved it if Joni had been like, pardon me, asshole. I'm hungry. And like, there's sausage in that. Like, she's too short. Oh. She couldn't get up to the... Too short. Short legs.
Well, you know, it's nice to know that it probably wasn't some, you know, grisly relapse.
No. And, I mean, if it... You know, I don't know enough about... You tell me. Can you like... have secretly done a bunch of heroin 5 hours before and then go home and make dinner and then die from doing that? I mean,
it doesn't quite add up, but but it seems to me that he put himself and his body through a lot.
Yes, I think that's it. It caught up to him, you know?
You know, and if you don't know what you're like, I don't know when his last physical was. I mean, you could probably
He had
try.
One. I made him go and get one.
And what was the information
on that? All systems go.
Huh.
But you don't, I mean, this is what the... I'm going to be dealing with Mark's death for the rest of my life.
Yeah, it's probably not heart stuff then.
Well, I mean, right. Like this is, if you have a like blood clot, if you have an aneurysm is undetectable. I mean, you can't like, you can go, people, and this, we don't have any control over any of this. And the illusion is that like, if you take good care of yourself and you get physicals and you sort of like drink your green juice, that there's a sense of control over warding off death. And it's just not like that. And like Mark abused the shit out of his body, but that's also no guarantee that he was going to die in that way.
Sure.
And you can take really good care of yourself and you can get hit by a bus. I mean, you know, or die of something undiagnosed. It's just what happened.
Well,
and it's horrible.
It's horrible. But the one thing we do know was quick.
Yeah. And he was there with the two people in the world that he loved the most, which are those two dogs.
Oh, good.
Swear to God.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the book. And it was nice of you to dedicate it to him, of course.
Well, my friend Imran told a really potentially off-color but actually amazing joke about this when this happened, because Imran loved Mark and knew him very well and loves me. And he goes, so that's what it took, huh, to get...
to get
them, because it was dedicated to my parents.
Yeah.
And they got, this is the only thing Mark could have done. And I mean, you knew him quite well, and you guys have a shared sense of real black humor, and so do I. And Mark, I mean, I can hear him sometimes just being like, the biggest problem with that book was there was not enough of me in it, so I had to do something.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, yeah, you got to have the dark humor so you don't, you know, so the bottom doesn't fall out.
Exactly.
Well, it's nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
That was fun. That was good. That was emotional in some ways. Don't forget, if you're in LA, you can join me and Brendan for our only LA book event and signing this Sunday, October 29th at 7 p.m. Go to livetalksla.org or the tour page of WTFpod.com. I can't play guitar. I'm tired and I'm a little depressed. Boomer lives!